Welcome back to the second hour of It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copeland. It's time for this week's in-depth interview with a special guest from the arts. And now, here's your host for It's a Question of Balance, Ruth Copeland.
Welcome back. If you're a new listener to the show, I want to let you know that this is a two-hour show in which we try to explore whether we have more in common than divides us. In the first hour of the show, we ask questions that matter, avoiding politics, instead focusing on the issues that underlie politics and current events, issues that affect us all, young or old, locally and globally. And then in this, the second hour, we balance the creative with the intellectual by featuring in-depth interviews with local, national and international guests from the arts. And the show combines a debate topic with an arts interview because I feel discussion and creativity are two of the most vital ways we engage with the world. It's all a question of balance. And remember, if you'd like to find out more information about the show, you can go to the website. It's a questionofbalance.com. Well, this week, as my special guest from the arts, I'm pleased to be interviewing British vocalist and toaster Ranking Roger. As an original member of seminal 80s two-tone band The Beat, or The English Beat as they're known in America, Roger has a career in music that spans over three decades. Joining The Beat at just 16, his mum had to sign his first record contract for him. The Beat's first single went straight into the top 10 in the UK, and three albums followed with multiple hit singles, including Mirror in the Bathroom, Too Nice to Talk To, and Hands Off She's Mine. From the outset, the band offered messages of hope and peace with an insight into socio-political topics, which would later, alongside The Specials, see them heralded as forerunners of the whole two-tone ska movement. Ranking Roger and Dave Wakeling led with vocals, while Andy Cox and David Steele took guitar and bass, with Everett Morton supplying distinctive drums and renowned saxophonist Saxa adding the warm Jamaican ska instrumental flavour that is forever associated with the band's sound. After the band split, Roger formed General Public with fellow Beat member Dave Wakeling, and the band found great success in North America. In the 90s, Roger joined members of The Specials to form Special Beat, which toured and released two live albums. Roger has also recorded two solo albums, Radical Departure and Inside My Head, which includes traditional reggae and ska with influences of electronica, jungle and dub, and also an album of collaborations with other artists. Roger continues to play live, performing both The Beat songs and material from throughout his career. He heads up The Beat in the UK, and the band regularly tours and records. The current lineup includes Roger's son, Ranking Jr., who contributed vocals and songwriting to The Beat's 2014 album, and Roger's daughter, Saffron. Welcome to the show, Roger.
Thank you for having me, Ruth. What a great intro. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Well, it's easy because you've had a great career. So
I've almost forgot how much history there was. You know, I've just carried on getting on with it and not really looking back that much. You know,
yes,
you should. But I think if you do, you give time for pause. So now it's onwards. You know, all the time.
Yes, yeah. Well, I think generally in life it's better to do that, to keep moving forward. But I mean, when you look back, you must have some amazing memories and, you know, things to think about, that's for sure.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, through the years, toured and met some of my biggest favourite stars, you know, and hung out with them. And you know, it's phenomenal what you can learn from other people, you know, and I think human interaction is so important that when, you know, when I met people like Sting or The Clash, I was surprised how down-to-earth. I thought they would have been really big-headed, but they were very down-to-earth and grounded people, and I think that affected the way I've looked at my outlook in life. You know, I've just tried to keep it real and down-to-earth, you know, same kind of way.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you do learn. I suppose if your hero was a diva or very egoistic, then you probably would probably think that's the way you should be. But I think around the time when we were da-da pop stars, if you like,
yeah,
you know, in the late 70s early 80s, it was kind of I think when people were famous, they were very cool with it. You know, it wasn't just about being famous. A lot of it was about fashion, but yeah. A lot of it was about being a realist, you know.
Mm.
So that's how the politics got into the songs, was because we were singing about everything we saw around us.
Yes, yeah.
You know, including love, including war, you know, and it all got meshed into one crazy dynamic, you know, mix of sound, and, you know, the beat was born.
Yeah.
You know, I, up to this day, I've never heard another band that sounds like the Beat, you know, that kind of...
No.
Very dimensional, and it incorporates, you know, reggae, punk, ska, calypso, soul, a bit of disco or dance. You know, it's got everything in there, but yet, you know, every time you hear a beat tune, you knew it was us.
Yeah, no, absolutely true. I wanted to ask you, your professional career in music started very early at 16 when you joined the Beat, or the English Beat as it's known in the US. I'm wondering if you can share with us your earliest experience of music and how it affected you.
Well, I started off, I was still at school at the time, I was 16, and I joined a band called the Dum Dum Boys. They were a punk band, and I was their drummer. We did about 3 or 4 shows, and all of a sudden, we were in a situation where we could do our first headline show, and the Beat came up. There were a 4-piece then, came up and approached us and said, we'd love to open up for you. We said, go on then, come to our rehearsal, see what you like. If you're any good, you can open up for us. And good golly, they were good. We had them open up for us, and they blew us off stage, but, you know, I later went on to join them. You know, I started following them around. We became really good friends, and I started jumping up on stage and toasting for them, if you like, emceeing, as it's called nowadays.
Yeah.
And people loved it, and I became an intricate part of the band, and it was, what a great story. I mean, I was lucky because I hadn't even left, well, I had left school, but officially, not really, because I left school the day I turned 16, and I think it was probably about March or April of that year, when I joined the Beat, and I turned 16 in February, so I didn't even take my exams. I mean, that's appalling now I look at it and think about it. But I think if I didn't go for it then, I would never have had the position, and I would never have been in that situation again. Who knows? Maybe I would have, but I think that was the right time for me to do what I had to do, and I went straight into music and did what I knew I could do.
Yes.
And within 9 months of joining the Beat, we were top 10 in the charts. So very, very, very lucky. And at such a young age, and trying to hold all the fame in.
Yes.
You know, because everywhere you went, people knew you all of a sudden, and you were, you know, this week's fashion, and Two Tone was the biggest thing. You know, we were the 4th hit single on Two Tone, and everybody was watching it. And then you start meeting the creators behind the label, and the creators and the band members, like, we started linking with the Selector and Madness and the Specials and people like that, and realizing how down to earth and grounded they were really. So they cared about their audiences, they cared about the world situations. Everybody's fear then was World War III. That was everybody scared that was going to happen then, and nuclear holocaust. So again, other bands like The Clash and The Police had the same kind of mindedness, if you like. And then we toured with The Talking Heads, and, we found they were kind of like-minded as well. So I think, as I say, the musicians around that kind of time were very grounded and real. And I think the musicians in the 90s, they became the divas and the airheads and the, not all of them, but, there seemed to be a lot more of them, people who insisted that this should be like this, and you should be thankful for what you've got, and thankful you're still here breathing, and that's the way I look at it,
Yeah, absolutely. So the 70s ska revival melded punk and traditional ska, which on the face of it, they don't really seem a natural fit, but, it worked. How did you become drawn to that particular genre of music? What excited you about, being part of that ska revival?
Well, I didn't know it was going to be a ska revival at the time. At the age of 15, I became a punk. And
right.
I had all the bondage stuff inside my ear. I mean, I was still at school and stuff, and people already knew me as Ranking Roger. That was the name I gave myself from the time I was 13, you know, so everyone knew me as that. And I used to go down to these punk discos and MC on the mic, and the punks used to love it. And to me, I didn't even realise that at the time till I heard, you know, things like Police and Fees by The Clash, that punk bands were actually attempting to try anything reggae-ish. But I did notice that at these punk discos, they did play a lot of reggae as well.
Mm.
And a lot of punks used to turn around and say, you know what, some of the things what the reggae people are saying and some of the things what the punks are saying are the same kind of things, you know. So there was definitely a connection there from a long time ago. It's basically, it's poor people, simple, you know.
Yeah.
And it's the same plight worldwide. So, yeah, we had a lot in common. And I think that put the first idea in my head that punky reggae music could work, you know, and people should unite as one and try and change things through peaceful means, you know, and music was my peaceful way of doing it, you know?
Yes, yeah. You're known for your distinctive vocal and toasting style, and toasting's been used in various African traditions as well as Jamaican music forms, and has influenced or been integrated into many music genres such as ska, reggae, dancehall, dub and hip-hop, as well as two-tone. I'm just wondering, for listeners who are perhaps unfamiliar with toasting and how it kind of differs from rap, could you give us a feel for what toasting is?
Well, I could tell you that it's a Jamaican accent,
right,
of rapping, if you like. So it's the same as rapping, but in a Jamaican accent. So, I mean, I could say something like, here's a bit from a tune of mine called Dangerous, and this would be a bit of rapping as an example. I could say, oh, that man, oh, that I come, car any time he come, I said him well troublesome. Oh, that man, oh, that I come, is I man Ranking Raja with this song I go down. So I hope people could understand that. I was just saying, who is that man? Who is that man coming? Because any time he comes, he's well troublesome. That's me, musically. You know, musical rebel I like to be.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and obviously I'm saying it's Ranking Raja with the sound that's going down, you know. So obviously that's kind of an example of toasting.
Right.
My nice soft voice, not my hard way. I've got
yes.
ways of doing it. But yeah, that's what it is basically, is, you know, Jamaican rapping.
Yeah, and I mean, I think in the African traditions, it's very much about storytelling, which is interesting because, of course, rapping, that, you know, it's predominantly what that is. So it's the way it's carried through into sort of a more modern feel.
Well, definitely. And I mean, even all the MCs nowadays, you know, what I see in England doing the drum and bass stuff. I mean, they call it spitting, and I'm just like, you can't call it that, you know. But, I mean, you know, to them, stick is brilliant, and I think, you know, and,
yeah.
you know, bad is good, you know. So, I don't know, it's all changed, but I mean, what they're going on with is exactly the same thing, but it's more advanced, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, a lot of props and respect to those guys, because, you know, they... Some of them don't know who I am, but when they hear about the history, they always show me props and respect, because I guess I was like one of the guys at the forefront, people like me and Neville Staple, who had to step into an arena where this type of thing was never heard of, and people actually, you know, frowned upon it, you know. And nowadays people listen to toasting and I think this is cool, man, you know, especially the kind of hook lines that you can come out with, you know.
Yeah.
So it has come all the way around, and I'm really pleased about that.
Yeah.
Well,
we're talking to Ranking Roger here. He's my special guest from the arts this week. We're going to go to a short break now, but we'll be back after these messages. You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland.
Like the
to music from It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copeland. Have you ever wondered what the full songs sound like? Now you can find out by listening to the new EP, It's a Question of Balance Music, available from iTunes, Amazon, and itsaquestionofbalance.com. It's a Question of Balance Music. Download individual tracks or the whole EP from iTunes, Amazon, or itsaquestionofbalance.com.
Ciao, I'm Luca from Tramonti at 528 Seabright Avenue, steps from the ocean. We are the authentic Italian pizza and pasta restaurant, serving also organic salad and house-made desserts in a friendly, family-style atmosphere, indoor or on our lovely patio.
Tramonti is open every day from noon to 9 and later on Fridays and Saturdays. Come enjoy our specials every Tuesday neighborhood night and the best deal for a healthy bite at lunch every day.
We bake our bread and prep our fresh pasta and pizza daily. Beppe, Daniel and I want to say grazie to the Santa Cruz community for supporting us in the past 2 years. Allora, buon appetito!
Visit Luca and Beppe at Tremonti, 528 Seabright Avenue. That's Tremonti, 528 Seabright Avenue.
Welcome back to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copeland, and my special guest, British vocalist and toaster ranking Roger, original member of the two-tone band The Beat, or the English Beat as they're known here in America. And Roger, two-tone incorporated a racial integration that was somewhat at odds with the time. It was certainly a counter to the rise of the sort of racist, fascist National Front organization. I'm wondering, did you think much about race and two-tone making a statement, or was it all about the music and just getting the right people together to make it, regardless of colour?
I think definitely both.
Okay.
At the time when I was growing up, when I was like between, obviously around the ages of 12 and 15, I lived in an area called Stechford, which was the headquarters for the National Front, and they were a very right wing organization, and they used to have marches up and down my street. So yes, I always felt threatened from a young age, but then at the same time I would notice, you know, all my neighbors coming out and snarling at them and waving the fist and going, you lot are mad, you don't know what you're doing, you know, and you're looking at it the wrong way, and you know, the chants that went on. So I realised that within the community, the majority of people were against racism, and it seems so today, just like it was in the olden days, that it's always a small minority who were, to me, the problem or the racist. And I don't know if you'll ever be able to eliminate racism fully, but yes, it was there definitely a big time in the 70s. And when bands like The Specials and The Beat came out, we educated the population and made them know, yes, black people are friendly, you know, we're not all thugs. I think people took to that, and there was a big downfall for the right-wing parties who have come up and down all the time. I mean, as I say, they'll always be there, but it's just keeping them at bay, really. And I think that can only be done by people power, because we all have to live together at the end of the day. And, you know, wherever you live in the world, you get something from another country. Not everything's made in America, or not everything's made in England. It's from everywhere. Everyone's involved, you know.
Yeah.
So we should look at it. We should look at it like that. You know, people are people, and it's what you bring to the community and to the table that matters.
Yeah.
I mean, getting back to the point, I mean, we didn't know that, or I didn't know that the beat was going to end up as three black guys and three white guys. That wasn't intentional. That's just the way it turned out. So we were just the right people for the job that needed to be done at the time. That's the best way I can look at it. And, you know, the same for the specials. I think, you know, I think it was planned to have black and white guys playing together because they were mates.
Yeah.
But the whole thing of spreading the love and unity thing you know, trying to show people that we're all the same, I think that came later, you know. It's one of those things that had to be addressed, because it was a thorn in society, and you had people like the Anti-Nazi League going around trying to counter that, and a lot of bands like the Specials and UB40 and the Beat and lots of other bands came through that organisation, through the concerts they used to keep, the Clash as well, you know.
Yes.
Which were anti-racist gigs. So, yeah, there was a big concern then. Seems bigger than, I mean, nowadays it's a different kind of racism that I see in England, and it's not necessarily aimed at black people. I don't really notice the kind of racism I noticed when I was a kid. You know, it's a different kind of racism, and it's more towards, in England, it's more towards Eastern European people, which is a shame, and the Polish. And I'm just like, well, you know, hold it down. The people come over and they work hard, so, you know, give them a break.
Yeah,
that's my honest opinion from what I've seen. Anyway, I don't know. I know them to like a drink, but I don't really know them to be troublemakers. Like, you know, I think they've come here to try and make a living, you know.
Well, I think it's just always
thing,
it's kind of, well, it's always just this thing of the other. I think, you know, the people who tend to be racist are just looking to feel better about themselves and project some of their own stuff onto other people. And so, like you said, it doesn't necessarily have to be a colour thing. You know, there's a big immigrant issue here in America also, you know, with the Hispanic population, and it just seems a cyclical thing. And I think, you know, what was really interesting about Two Tone and what the Beat did was this sort of idea of multiculturalism. And, you know, what was kind of ironic is, you know, a lot of skinheads who, you know, traditionally were, you know, perhaps members of the National Front and leaning right, liked Two Tone, didn't they? It was kind of like their music, which was interesting.
And it was, you know, it was part of the idea to try and win some of those people across, to try and change their minds. I mean, you know, 30 years later, big 6 foot skinheads come to my gigs still sometimes. You know? I mean, we have quite a mix of people.
Yeah.
It's a lovely crowd what we have.
Yeah.
And, you know, these skinheads, I've heard guys who I've looked at talk to me, and, you know, they're praising me and going, you know, thank you so much for the music. I used to be National Front, and you guys changed the way I thought, and you made a big difference, and look at the, and they're hugging me and everything, and I'm thinking, good gosh, they could have been strangling me. But no, actually, we made a difference to, you know, those characters, and maybe they were just a bit misguided, or they were just unfamiliar with what it's like to mix with people of, you know, different cultures or different, you know, because that's the exciting thing about life, is learning about other people and complimenting, if you like. I think that's exciting, you know.
Absolutely.
But at the same time, when I look at the whole Two Tone thing, I can tell you as a prediction that, well, because I've never seen it since, that could never happen in England again the way it happened. It was so much of an accident. It took society by storm, almost the same way like punk did. It was the best thing that happened since punk, you know, and all of a sudden, one day on the Daily Mirror, it was like shock news. These punks, and is your kid a punk? And they started, it was on the front of all the papers and stuff, and the Sex Pistols got big, and then punk got a real bad name. But with the scar thing, or the Two Tone thing, it was almost like we kind of carried on where punk left off, but even with more humour, you know, and more, you know, we were more serious about what we were saying. I mean, they were serious, but it sounded like they were off their heads, or there was, I don't know what it sounded like. I mean, I love punk music, don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
But
I think Two Tone's more accessible, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, we, you know, the Two Tone guys wore ties and were smart and they were modish and they had something to say, and it was to the working class people. And, you know, that's so important. It got through.
Yeah.
And they put a cap on it. They, you know, I could feel that. It wasn't supposed to have got through because it's too political, you know. According to the BBC at the time, politics and music don't work, you know, and you can't have politics in music because, it, you know, music had to be kept neutral, you know. And things like Maggie's Farm went in by the Specials and, you know, Ghost Town went in and, you know, Stand Down Margaret went in, and that, we got banned for that one, you know. But, you know, the amount of people it got through to, you know, or the miners who were on strike, I heard them singing it on the news. I heard the women at Green and Common singing it on the news. You know, so I know that tune got through, and all the proceeds went to Greenpeace, you know. So I'm so proud.
Yeah.
I did something, put my money where my mouth was, if you like, and took none of it, and we gave it to Greenpeace, and so proud of that, really good thing. So that's probably the best thing we ever did, you know.
Yeah.
As the Beat.
Well, I'd like...
showed people we believed in what we said. Yeah.
Absolutely, yeah. I'd like to play a Beat track, Mirror in the Bathroom, which is one of my favourite tracks, and this is a great mix by Gaudi. The mix is by Gaudi. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Yes.
Yeah, so it's an interesting take on Mirror in the Bathroom. So let's hear that now. This is The Beat.
But here comes the music I think keep rocking and swing. So all they got to do is keep on coming down. I'm going to close out to the body. So I keep rocking and swing the way down with that, baby. Do it, y'all. Great songs called The Mirror in the Bathroom. I would tell ya. So all they got to do is keep on coming down and boogie.
Mirror. mirror in the bathroom.
Mirror, mirror,
mirror in the bathroom. Mirror in the bathroom.
Well, that was Mirror in the Bathroom, Gaudi mix by The Beat, or The English Beat, as they're known here in the US, featuring my guest, Ranking Roger. And I wanted to play that track because I love that track. You say it was one of your favorites. I mean, at the time, I didn't really think about what it was about, you know, narcissism and such. But what was the impetus behind this song?
Well, first of all, in that last version there, what you heard, doing the emceeing or the toasting was my son, Ranking Jr.
Oh, right. Okay, I didn't realize that. Okay.
They're doing the emceeing and I was doing all the singing. So that's kind of like reverse roles, if you like.
Oh, cool.
So Mirror in the Bathroom was kind of written before I joined the band. So it was about, you know, people who fancied themselves, if you like. the best thing I could do for the team was, once I'd heard it and we were in the studio, helped to shape it up to make it what it was. But it was one of those tunes which didn't really need much to it anyway. It was kind of ready-made, you know.
Yes.
And it, you know, from what Dave Wakeling told me, it was one day he was on his way to work and he spent so long looking in the mirror it made him late for work, you know. So obviously, you know, that was the whole thing about mirror in the bathroom, please yeah. talk free kind of thing.
That's cool.
And
yeah.
that kind of inspired the song to be written. So,
yeah.
But the music, I mean, the bass player for The Beat was a genius. And he came up with the, you know, the whisper, mirror in the bathroom, twist and crawl. You know, the very strange ones, too nice to talk to, you know, the almost jilted ones where you go, that's an odd bass line. And, when, you know, the more you hear it, the more you go, man, that's groovy. I mean, obviously, he listened to a ton of Motown music. And that's the funny thing about The Beat was, when we were on the tour bus in America, there were so many different styles of music coming from where you wouldn't expect it. I mean, I'd be the one I'd play a lot of punk on the bus.
Yeah.
And you know, some dub reggae as well. But it was like Andy Cox and Dave Wakeling would be the ones who were playing most of the African tunes, for instance. You know? And I was like, where are you finding these tunes, man, and the melodic guitars? And by the time we got to the third album, you can hear there was an African influence on the beat. So we'd been listening to so much. But it was so diverse what we heard on the bus. It just went through a whole mass of music, and it was brilliant. Well, an education.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, I heard about people like Captain Beefheart for the first time, you know, because he was like a, you know, 60s and 70s hero. I got educated along the way, and I educated those guys about what was happening now and all the latest MCs and all the latest, you know, things that were out there. So it was kind of a great exchange, you know, of musical knowledge.
Yeah. Well, if you just joined us, you're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland, and my special guest, Ranking Roger, from The Beat, or The English Beat, as it's known here in the US. We're going to go to a break now, but we'll be back after these messages. Thanks for listening.
Did you know about the Santa Cruz Art League on Broadway in Santa Cruz? Founded in 1919, it's 96 years young and provides a wonderful gallery space for local and national artists. It's a great place to view art with 14 shows a year, and also to gain support if you're an artist yourself. There are art classes and weekend workshops, many taught by open studio artists. If you become a member, you receive a newsletter, discounts on classes, gifts and exhibit entries, images of your art on the Art League website, and guaranteed participation in the annual members show. It's also a great place to meet artists. Visit the Santa Cruz Art League at 562 Broadway, or the website at scal.org. That's scal.org.
The
portion of the show is sponsored by Dina Scopatoni, who is an award-winning fashion model, academic teaching modern art history at Cabrillo College, and Vogue fashion photographer. An ocular centrist, Dina's photographs range from fashion editorials to soul-catching portraits to evocative documentary images. The vibrant nature of her work evokes the glamour of Mario Testino, Annie Leibovitz and Helmut Newton, while expressing an understanding of composition and contrast which is all her own. Trained as an art historian at the University of London's esteemed Courtauld Institute, Dina Scopatoni looks for the intellectual and visual contrasts in each of her photographs. If you're interested in viewing her wonderful work, you can go to dinascopatoni.com. That's dinascopetoni.com. Welcome back. You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland, and my special guest from the arts this week, Ranking Roger. I wanted to play next a great Alexana remix of Rock the Casbah. And also to mention, you said you enjoyed touring most with The Clash and the Police. I was just wondering what was special about those tours.
The number one thing being, like, you know, that they were like my main heroes. I mean, I bought a Police album before I even met any of them. So even though I thought they were a bit more on the poppy side, I thought they were good because they were one of the first bands who I think, you know, tried to mesh reggae and, if you like, because it wasn't punk, it was new wave, but they tried to mesh, you know, put the two of them together. Mm. So I gave them props from day one. Even though I thought, well, maybe Sting might be trying to sound a bit too much like Bob Marley.
Mm.
But he did, I mean, you know, tunes like Roxanne are classics. You know, you can't knock them no matter what you do. They're just so full of emotion. And
yeah.
I thought, when I first heard that tune, I thought, such an odd tune, you know, but that's why they were so successful, because it was so different, you know. And radical for the time, you know.
Mm.
But then when I actually got to meet the Police, I thought they were just so grounded, and like Stuart Copeland was just, had his camera everywhere and filming everything and always smiling and laughing and having a joke. And he had the time to go to the lowest of lowest and say, hi, how you doing, you know, and have a friendly banter with you, you know.
Yeah.
And Sting, the one who I thought who was going to be the most kind of, you know, I thought he would have been a diva, if anything, because by the time I'd met him, he'd already had a few number ones in America. So that's, you know, you already know that's mega. And he was just, you know, so down to earth and cool. And obviously the Police loved the band, loved the beat. So they had us on tour with them again and again and again. They kept on asking for us. And luckily, at the same time, their manager was our record company, and the drummer's brother was our agent in America, touring agent. So, I mean, there was a bit of a family thing going on there,
yeah.
You know, from time,
yeah.
Built ties and that. You know, and as far as The Clash went, I just thought, they were the most aggressive-sounding music, but the nicest people, and if you could ever see, the people who saw the live Clash shows are the luckiest people in the world, because being there is not the same as listening to it on a record or listening to a recording of it. Actually being there was something else, the vibe, the atmosphere of the crowd and everything. And you could feel and hear that the musicians meant it. So I'd give the Clash total props. I know they had problems and they split up in the end. But, you know, they were like brothers in arms when they went on there. It was like they were fighting a battle for humanity, you know. I really respect that band.
Mm.
And off stage, you know, again, I felt really welcomed. Not many people were allowed in their dressing room, but I was, you know. Anytime I could come in, grab a beer, sit down, play music, and go and, like, to my room kind of thing. And, you know, me and Mick became really good friends because we were gadget freaks. We were into the latest gadgets. So that's probably why he probably ended up joining General Public when we first began after the beat split up. And later on, I joined Big Audio Dynamite for a couple of years, which was quite fun as well. So, you know, me and him have held something over the years. Whereas me and Joe, I mean, I just saw Joe as like a big brother because he always saw me like a little brother.
And
the man was so powerful and had a lot to say, but had such a kind heart. So, I mean, that's why, because those people were so down to earth, you know. A lot of people, well, people might even remember, REM used to open up for the beat as well. And
wow, yeah.
Before they got massive, you know, and I used to really love hanging out with them guys too, because what I'd learned from the other bands, I kind of passed on. So maybe that's why they're so down to earth as well. And, you know, they were the biggest rock and roll band in the world at one time. So I think it does pass on and pass through, you know, and it's important that if you can remain grounded, then maybe 30 years later, you might be doing an interview like myself.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, it is an achievement because so many people kind of start believing their own PR and just lose all sense of, you know, reality. I think. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, it's a real achievement. So this remix, this is you emceeing on this, is it? On the Alex Anna remix of Rock the Casbah?
Yes. It's me and Ranking Jr., actually.
Both of you, okay.
He does the first verse, I do the second verse, and we both sing the choruses kind of thing.
Oh, cool. Okay. Well, let's hear that now. Yeah. This is Rock the Casbah.
Yeah.
Well, that was Rock the Casbah, great mix there, which features Ranking Roger, my special guest, and also your son, Roger, who's part of the current beat lineup, Ranking Junior.
That's right.
Yeah, and the new material you're producing is a mix of chill, dance, or EDM, as it's called here, drum and bass, rap and ska, and you continue to evolve new musical feels whilst also integrating favourites from the beat catalogue. How do you see your musical evolution going forward? What can we look forward to?
Well, I think it's important, as I learned from the very beginning, to try a bit of everything and see the best way of merging the musics together. I don't think it always works, but when it does, then you end up with beat-style music, and I think it's, a lot of people are now experimenting and, you know, pulling this type of music with this type of music, and it's working, so that is the way forward. All I'm doing is I'm still learning, that's all.
Yeah.
I don't think you ever stop learning. I wish I'd learned everything, but no, I think it'd be boring then. The fact that you don't know what's around the corner, which means there's still a lot to learn, is the thing that keeps me, you know, wanting to, you know, keep writing music and try different styles and try a bit of Indian this time, mix that up with a bit of ragga and then mix that up with a bit of hip-hop, you know, and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. But as I say, a new style of music will come from it, and this is how new styles are created, from different styles. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I was going to ask you, you know, what inspires you, you know, to continue your journey with music after you've recorded so many albums with The Beat, General Public, Special Beats, solo album. You've done some amazing collaborations with some amazing people. And I guess that's it, you know, that you're just constantly wanting to push the envelope of what you can do with music.
I love it. It's my love. If you took it away from me, I'd really feel like I was in prison or hell, definitely.
Yeah.
It's one of those things that I've heard from I was a child, and you know, even when I go to sleep, I'm listening to music. So it's, you know, it's been something that's been continual all my life. It's always been there, and the love for it is, you know, second to none.
Yeah.
It's that kind of dedication, I suppose. That's the kind of, you know, that's how I feel my approach is to music. I mean, of course, there are times where you don't want to hear any of it and you need a break from it. Of course, we're only human, but at the same time, I know it's what I'm best at, and it's like a bit like a puzzle to me. For someone who can't read a note of music, I have a very good way of organising it.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, we're coming towards the end of the show, but I wanted to ask you, art historically has been used to convey social justice messages, but there's always the danger of the art kind of losing out to the message. You know, if you're talking about unemployment, racism, inequality, the danger is you can get a bit preachy, but you seem to have dodged this bullet with all your work, and I'm wondering what you think the key is to making art that inspires musically but also has a message.
I think put the music first. And what I mean by that is, in order to get anything across to anybody, it has to be a brilliant melody and a brilliant rhythm. If you get those two, rhythm and melody, get those together with a great arrangement. And it's, you know, it's all about getting a classic arrangement. And once you've got that, you can drop any kind of lyric you want into it. It can just be a simple love song, or it can be a worldly love song, you know. And that's down to the writer then, you know.
Yes.
But I think a lot of it starts from, a lot of writers say it starts from the lyrics, and then the music's made around it. But I think, and this is the way I do it, I build the music first, and then I write the lyrics around the music, which is totally reverse to the way other songwriters I know write. They always come up with a lyric first.
Right. Yeah. That's interesting. Well, I was going to play out with a track called 16 Tons, which actually you recorded originally for your last album, Pop Off Your Head. But this version I have is your daughter, Saffron, singing. I understand she's going to be joining the band or working with the band going forward. Is that correct?
Definitely. Well, she's done a couple of shows with the band when we played Ireland recently, because that's where she lives.
Right.
She came on, did two shows with us, and the crowd went absolutely mad. And then, you know, I said, if you want to come and do some of the festivals around the UK with us this summer, you'd be more than welcome. And, you know, she's studying music business at college, and so she's got the time off to do it in July and August. So she's going to come over for those 2 months and see how she takes to the big stage. She can do it already.
Yeah.
And she's recorded with me in my studio here in Birmingham at home, you know, a few times. So she's not scared of it. And, you know, she's got a fantastic voice, you know.
I
mean, the 16 Tons, she just come over from Ireland, and I said, I want you to sing this song with me. And basically, she listened to my vocals, and the next day she went in and sung it kind of her way. And basically, I sent those back to the producer, and he came back with my version, but later on, sent the version with just her. So that's kind of
brilliant.
Obviously, it's a testament, it's quite good.
Yeah, well, we better play it, otherwise, we'll be out of time. But thank you so much for talking to me.
Thank you. You've been absolutely brilliant, and I've really enjoyed this. Thank you very much. Thank you.
You're very welcome. I've really enjoyed it too. So here we are. This is 16 Tons by Alexana featuring Saffron.